Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Show through BBS Radio. We're on every second Saturday for 2 hours, exploring mystical and spiritual teachings, modern science, creation physics, and the like. I'm coming to you from Ontario, Canada, and my co-host, who I'll bring on, is James Moffitt from Toronto, Ontario. Jim, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. I thought today's show we're going to... I had a little talk I wanted to do at the beginning of the show. I had a particular theme I wanted to talk on for a few minutes. And then we were going to review two books that we've both been working with. And I think it'll be an interesting show, looking at near-death experiences and afterlife states and the physics of consciousness. So I think I hope we'll have a good show today. And you remember, Jim, we had Kenny J on once before. He sang a song for us.
Yep.
Kenny J's here with me today, and we're all set up. So I thought maybe we'd open our show today with Kenny's song, and then I'll give my little talk, and we'll move ahead with our book reviews. Sound good?
Sure.
Okay, so the name of the song, it's... written and played by Kenny J, and it's called Look at This World. And I think it's a moving song, and one of the main lines in it that really attracted my attention and interest was concerning the chemtrail spraying of the skies. And this talks about the chemtrail spraying and look at this world, the poisoning of the world, and also the song inspires us in a way to let's take back our world and stop these things from being done and being responsible. Okay, so this then is Kenny J, and the song is called Look at This World.
and that was Look at This World by Kenny J.
Thank you, Kenny.
How'd that come across, Jim? It's hard to play original music into a telephone.
It was hard to hear the... I couldn't hear the lyrics that well. But
yeah, hard to hear the lyrics.
It's like a really
yeah.
good busker who's down the hallway in the subway.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I hope by the next show we're going to have an MP3 of it. So we'll just upload it to BBS and it can be a theme song for our show. Yeah. So thanks, Kenny J, and we'll move to have him on our show in the future again. I'm going to shift, Jim. I'm on the downstairs phone here. I'm going to just shift upstairs, and we can kind of move into our show here. I'll get you just say hello to Kenny J for a minute.
Okay.
Hello, Jim. How are you?
Hello. Oh,
hello, Jim.
Oh, hi, Kenny. I like.
Hi, how are you tonight?
Good. It was a little bit difficult to hear the lyrics, but I liked it. Maybe I was going to ask you, maybe Chris, you could give Chris the chords and the lyrics, and you can email them to me. I like to learn the song.
Right.
I like to try to learn the song.
Oh yeah, it's a great song. I think you'll really enjoy it.
Yeah, I like the I like the changes.
Excellent, excellent.
Yeah, it was very
okay,
good.
Well, are you back on the line?
Yeah, I'm back on the line here. Thanks, Kenny J.
Okay, thanks again, eh? We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Chris.
Yeah.
I just asked Kenny if he could, maybe you can email me the chords and the lyrics, because I'd like to learn the song.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've got the lyrics, which I did up for Kenny, and I'll get him to put the... chords on it. Excellent.
Yeah, I'd like to learn it. I was telling him I like the changes. I like the music.
Yeah, it's quite. Kenny has a really nice kind of clear, kind of classic folk style.
Yeah.
You know, I love the accordion in it, and the harmonica. Sorry, always reminds me of Dylan.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Which was such inspired music. So, okay, well, I wanted to open a little bit by just a concept that has been on my mind lately, and this idea has to do with the idea of there being a form of nothingness at the heart of being. And I'd like to just talk a little bit about this concept. And it's the main focus of these shows is that Jim and I are trying to explore alternate views of the origin and nature of human consciousness. And within science and society today, it's generally agreed that this is the number one unsolved enigma, I would say, facing us in understanding the nature of life and the nature of human existence, is this kind of ultimate mystery of consciousness. And it's very hard to define what is meant by consciousness. And the word is used in 1,001 ways by all different kinds of researchers and people from different perspectives. So there's a great, it's like the Tower of Babel. Everyone speaks a different language in how they use the term consciousness and what is meant by that. So Jim and I mean, this has been the main focus of our show for years, and we still can't exactly define what consciousness is or is not in a way we talk around it and about it and so on, because in a way a person has to approach it in their own self-study to understand what the consciousness is within them. But this idea of consciousness as a form of nothingness is very interesting. And I'd like to compare that for the moment with the nature of space. Because if you consider, what is the nature of space? And we all exist at this moment within space. And it's in science usually considered to be three-dimensional space. And there's a fourth dimension of time, according to Einstein's theory of relativity, where time is seen as a fourth dimension of space, and in a way treated as on a continuum. So we exist within space. Now, what is the nature of space? And if we consider that just in terms of sensation, and we can't touch space, we can't see it, because space has no color, it's not material, we can't touch it, we can't smell it, we can't sense it. In a way, space itself is a form of no-thingness. Space is kind of like the no-thingness, but we can only be aware of all the things because of the space, which is the no-thingness. Okay, so this is like paradoxical, but this is very important because this is analogous to what the nature of consciousness is. In a way, consciousness is like this form of no-thingness at the heart of being. And because there is that no-thingness, that enables us to be aware of all the things. And what are all the different things? Well, I could be conscious of my thoughts, or feelings, or sensations, or impulses, or desires. I can be conscious of all these different things, but these things form on the object side of consciousness. They're not consciousness themselves. Like thinking is not consciousness, okay, nor is emotions, nor is sensation. Consciousness somehow is something separate from thinking and feeling and sensation. Consciousness is like this form of no-thingness that enables us to be aware of all the different things. And I would say that this extends even into being aware of alternate realities. Like at the moment, people identify with being in one particular space-time complex. Okay, but in a way, that consciousness, we could be conscious within another dimension of existence, and then we would be conscious of things which also we could sense and touch and so on different planes of existence. But the consciousness would still be this no-thingness. So the idea is that, yeah, there's this no-thingness, which is what allows us to be aware of things. Now, years ago when I was a university student, and I studied the philosophy of Jean-Paul Sartre, who is a very profound existentialist, and he wrote a famous book called Being and Nothingness. And Sartre was making, even though he comes from a theistic viewpoint or perspective, like denying the existence of spirit or soul or of God, I think that of Sartre. But he had this idea, view of consciousness, that consciousness, he says most things, they are what he called being in itself. Like a table is a table is a table. It just, it's established in its own nature. It is what it is. Whereas he said consciousness, he said, is something different, because consciousness he called a being for itself. And I don't understand his choice of terms, but what he says about consciousness, he says you're always conscious of something. So consciousness always has this property of intentionality. It intends something beyond itself. But consciousness is never these things. Like you can be conscious of your thoughts and your emotions and feelings, all these things, but these are all impermanent and they pass away. But what remains is this consciousness. I'm losing my point a little bit. But in Sartre, he saw consciousness as having this inherently negative or negative quality, that all consciousness was always a conscious of something which the consciousness is not. So the consciousness is not, never has an identity in a way. And this is how Sartre saw human beings, is that we don't have a fixed essence. There's this consciousness which negates everything, because everything we are aware of, we are not this, we are not that. Everything we're aware of, we are not. So consciousness is like this nothingness at the heart of being. And Sartre even used this term. And he saw that it was because of this nature of consciousness that Sartre regarded human beings as having this inherent capacity for freedom, to be free of the being in itself. Because somehow within ourselves we could always negate the being in itself. And that this consciousness in a way is this form of nothingness at the heart of being. And I think this is, it's hard, how would you test whether in the human being there's a form of nothingness at the heart of being? Okay, now I'm saying there's actually a higher dimensional physics to what I mean by this. It's not, I'm saying there's an actual science to this that we could try to understand. But I'll explain it in one way, which is very profound, by drawing upon some Kabbalistic teachings. And And in Kabbalah, it's said, like, before creation happens, there are said to be three realms of negative existence or pre-existence. And these are called Ein Sof, Hour, which correspond roughly with the idea of total nothingness, unspeakable. You can't even nothingness. And Ein Sof means the plenum, because the nothingness contains all of being. It's like it contains all possibilities in the plenum. And physicists today use the same term in describing the quantum vacuum. Okay, in a way, it's a form of nothingness, but within the nothingness is all the possible particles and forces of nature are all hidden in the nothingness. And the third Kabbalistic realm of negative existence is the Ein Sof Hour, which means the limitless light which fills the infinite all. So, and in Kabbalah, then, those are Ein Sof Hour are associated with the numbers 0, 0, 0, and 0, 0, 0. And those all together are said to constitute what's called negative existence. Now, when negative existence comes into existence, like the creation of the universe, the Kabbalist depicts the first point of unfoldment as being an infinitesimally small point. Okay, so that the Kabbalists for over hundreds of years now have depicted the universe emerging from a point source. And this is what science has arrived at in the last 30 years, is called a singularity. And I would call it a zero point, meaning it originated from a point so small it's beyond material perception. So in a way it disappears from view. So the Kabbalists then have this notion that before creation exists, you have these three realms of the infinite, Ein Sof Hour, and these fill all space. So in order for a finite universe or finite human beings to come into existence, God had to vacate a space. And this is called the Zimzum contraction. So what God, in a sense, did is he withdrew the infinite potencies and infinite light from a volume of space to create an apparent vacuum, which would then allow for a finite being to come into existence. Because if God hadn't done this, then every finite thing would be swallowed up again in the infinite. So there would be no possibility of differentiated existence. So in Kabbalistic teachings then, it's the Zimzum contraction has to do with the physics of the heart. And the idea is that there is an empty space within the heart, and that people in life subconsciously are pursuing, we're pursuing or striving to reattain and experience the initial condition of the heart. Until then, there's this nothingness in the heart of being, at the heart of being. And so people want to fill that nothingness. And Sartre saw people, he said, people can't face being nothing. People want to be something. And in a way, the search for ego and identity and possessions attaining things and so on were ways that human beings tried to fill the emptiness that they feel at the heart of being. Okay, so they try, if you own a lot of things, then your identity is wrapped up in your possessions, or it's wrapped up in your position and your authority, your relationships. So people don't want to be nothing, they want to be something. And people fear being nothing. Okay, but in the mystical way, in a way, we want to embrace the nothingness, because the nothingness is somehow essential to what we are as beings. It's because we are essentially this kind of nothingness at the heart of being that we could be conscious of all these things that go on in our lives and in other lives on other planes of existence. Because there's this form of nothingness at the heart of being. So what there's a famous Sufi quote. It's not by Rumi, I forget the fellow's name. He says, "Not since God brought man out of nothingness have we ceased to be travelers." And that's the basic concept, is that we come out of nothingness, and in a way we seek return, return to this prime source substance from which we emerge. And we try to fulfill the heart's desires. And people have all these different activities and things that they try to attain an identity, to become some kind of fixed being in itself. People can't face the impermanence of things. And so we live in what Sartre calls bad faith. We want to have a fixed identity. We don't want to be nothing. We want to be something. But in a way, the mystical path is to embrace the nothingness. And then what is revealed in the nothingness then might be found to be filled with limitless light, or one might have experiences of the plenum within the nothingness. So a lot of different mystical experiences involve this nothingness. I know in the Papa Roach song, which I quote on my website, in their lyrics, they say, because everything is nothing, and emptiness is in everything. And I just finished reading one of the books we're going to talk about today, where the scientist points out that scientists, physicists now realize that 99.9999% of space is empty. It's the world, in a way, it appears substantial and material, but in a way, it's illusory. It's the manner in which forces hold things together and their sizes and such. But really, space is mainly emptiness. And this is very profound teaching in Buddhism. Also, is this kind of emptiness at the heart of being. And so the idea often is, see, people cling to an identity, and in a way we cling to the ego, and we fear death. and what may lay beyond death, and whether we'll have continued personal identity. And in a way, in striving to know what we are, it's like everything you might think to describe what you are, anything you might say is wrong. It's a lie. It's not what you are. Okay, like I could say, well, I am Christopher Holmes. But the I is not a name, Christopher Holmes. That's a fixed social identity attached to my existence, and I refer to myself. But I am not my name. I'm not what I do. I'm not my thoughts. I'm not my feelings. And similarly, we may find I'm not my body. I am not this life. I'm something that is beyond this. So in a way, in the mystical path, we try to understand the nature of the nothingness at the heart of being. And in mystical teachings, it's said that when we come into existence, we become established within the heart early on and in what's called the bliss sheath, which is described as a mass of unemergent light the size of a small pea or a grape. And this is said to be the abode of the self within the heart, like it's the house of the zero-point center, that it is embodied in the bliss sheath. And when we're born, our consciousness is still centered in the bliss sheath, because even in the fetus, the growth begins from the heart. The heart differentiates very early on, and it's only much later that you have mental development and the neural development. So in mystical teachings, the heart is the essential center of a human being. And I lost my train of thought a little bit. But this is a very profound idea that there is... See, I'm arguing that the last century of modern science has been completely mistaken, assuming that the brain in the head... it somehow is producing human consciousness or being self-awareness. That's been the view of science for a century. And they've dismissed the idea that human spirit might have a spirit, might have a spirit or soul. Okay, and they regard it as superstitious that people might live in other dimensions or leave your body or have out-of-body experiences or view poltergeists and phenomena of this type. The phenomena of that type have been dismissed by science for over a century. So we haven't explored these areas properly. Instead, there's been this kind of materialist, reductionist view of human beings. And so we haven't developed the science of spirit and soul. And that's re-emerging now in part because of the profound ideas and concepts in quantum physics. And also in part because of the research on subjects like what we're going to talk about today, which are near-death experiences. Okay, so there's, in a way, there's a lot of evidence that human beings are not simply our material body, but instead there's all kinds of evidences for psychical phenomena, out-of-body experiences, reincarnation, other dimensions, and so on and so forth. So how could it all work? And that's what we're trying to understand, and not that we do. We don't understand it. I think these are lifelong mysteries that we pursue through different lives to try to understand and know what I am, or if there is an I. You see, in modern science and philosophy, no one thinks there is an individual I in a human being. No one thinks that. What they think is that neurons up in your head produce some sense of self within the mind, in the head. But they don't think that there is an I, an individual life center or element that brings consciousness and life into the body. And yet that is what is taught in all the different esoteric traditions, that there is some element, a God spark, a Jiva Atma, a monad, and these things are associated with the human heart. And the idea is that there's a higher dimensional physics to the heart. So when I say there's this zim-zum contraction and vacated space within the heart, I'm suggesting there's actually a physics to these things. It's part, actually, I argue that there is a higher dimensional holographic physics to the human heart. But to explain how that's possible is no easy task, and we approach it from many different angles and trying to elaborate it and understand it in different ways. But I did want to begin today's show talking a little bit about this notion of there being nothingness at the heart of being, and the idea of cultivating awareness in that, in a way, to be in the nothingness, to explore this issue in within yourself. I remember reading one of Paul Brunton's books, Search for Ancient Egypt, I think, and he meets Ramana Maharshi, famous yogi, and what he was taught was how to go into self-inquiry, where you ask, what am I? And you kind of go into that in your inner awareness and meditation or contemplation, exploring, what am I? And what you find is, like, I can be aware of my feet, but I'm not my feet, and I'm not my hands. And it's like everything you might say I to, you realize I is not. So if there's some kind of I, it has to have some other kind of existence. It's not like a thing, like a material element that exists in space-time. It has to do instead with the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. Mystics say that the self is connected to the heart. The higher self is not over your head up in space outside of you. It's within your heart. Even though there are higher faculties which can be represented as over the mind or out the third eye. But really, the essential self originates within, without, out of the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. And consciousness, in a way, it's hard to define what the consciousness is, because in a way, the consciousness is this no-thingness at the heart of being. And it's because of this no-thingness that we can be aware of all the different things that constitute not only this life, but which might constitute existence in other dimensions or in other lives. Because the essential consciousness, it is not this, it is not that, it is not anything. It's this form of nothingness. And it's similar to space, and it's also similar to light. It's very useful to understand consciousness in terms of light. And I would say consciousness is like light within empty space. So consciousness illuminates thoughts and feelings and so on, and allows us awareness of these different things. So consciousness is connected, in my view, most intimately to the idea of light and of space. And Aleister Crowley, in his depiction of consciousness, he uses the symbol of a point within a circle. And he explains this as the mystery of Hadit and Nui. And Hadit is the star center, the point source of light, the point source of supernal lux. And Nui, the circle, represents space. And Nui is a French word meaning night. So you might imagine looking in the night sky and see all the different stars in space. Well, Aleister Crowley and other people maintain in the mystical tradition that human beings similarly have this divine source or star nucleus within them. But it doesn't exist in lower dimensional, four-dimensional space. It exists in higher dimensional space, because Nui is not just four-dimensional space-time, but it's like the parent space or mother space. So for Crowley, to understand consciousness, he talks about it as a conjunction of Hadit and Nui, a point source star nucleus of light which exists within empty space or hyperspace of Nui. Okay, so that's mainly, I felt inclined to talk about the nothingness, Jim. partly from reading some of these, we've been reading two interesting books over the last while. Jim, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Sorry, yeah.
Any comments on what I was trying to say about the nothingness? It's very subtle, eh? These concepts are paradoxical and...
Yeah, it's very difficult. I mean, because you're sort of trying to... one thing is, I think, and I think you're getting to it in a way, is that in a sense, and especially when you're talking about the light in the space, is that there's a nothingness at the heart of being, but somehow the more you try to be aware of consciousness without identifying with anything, the more that light emerges and that you are aware of that nothingness, but in a very different way. Like it's incredibly complex and subtle process, and it obviously takes place over, well, from a mystical and esoteric perspective, it takes on a very different meaning because you do it over time, and it's, there's something of an cumulative experience. I mean, people can have experiences of cosmic consciousness or transcendent experiences, but there's also sort of a distinct dynamic that accompanies a spiritual search in terms of an esoteric teaching, and it is, in a sense, it's there's a process of, you know, it's like that exercise where people contemplate not that as to what they are, and it's sort of the melting away of the dissolution of the ego through the realization that everything that the ego is in relationship to something out there, but it's not really it. So it's a false ego, and you have to dissolve that false ego in order to realize. Like, that's the part I think that Sartre gets right, but I don't think he has the transcendent element, which is, he just says there's nothing, there's this nothingness, and I think he's absolutely right about kind of the existential dread that people have of their nothingness.
Yeah,
but
and with it, the fear of death,
which
for Sartre is so huge, and which for Gurdjieff is so important, like Gurdjieff, how Gurdjieff stresses the only thing that could wake people up is if they were reminded of the inevitability of their own death. And then I guess if we're reminded of that, then many of the things that we give time or are important to us would fall away. They would be insignificant to us. So
if you can be truly mindful of that, it's a means of disidentifying. What Gurdjieff talks in his theory about conscious shocks, and he says the first conscious shock is that you can intentionally invoke is to remember yourself, and it's very difficult to remember yourself, but to be aware of yourself. I am here. In general terms, is that the most simplistic way of describing it, and to try to maintain that state of presence, which is very, very difficult to do. And most of the time, we can't remember. We fall into waking sleep, and we become absorbed and embedded with everything which we identify with, either internally or externally. But then he never really identifies what the second conscious shock is. But I believe it's that emotional element of remembering the inevitability. He says if we could remember the inevitability of our own death and of everyone upon whom our eyes see, then everything would change. And I mean, I've tried to do that at various points in my life, try to remember that. It's very difficult to even remember to do it, but it does invoke a very strange and quite wonderful sense of emotional state, emotional presence. It's quite liberating, but it's so difficult to maintain it, especially with just trying to be aware of yourself being here. But I think that's something very, very important, and that's the part that I don't think that Sartre gets at all. Like,
yeah.
I think that's what I think is missing in his, as you say, I remember like years and years ago, 40 years ago, you used to come over because you were really interested in existentialism and phenomenology and give my brother and I these little mini lectures on existentialism, especially on Sartre. It's funny how that kind of all comes around, you know, like in some sense. Like there was something very essential that, and I think probably in some ways that prepared you to be more receptive to like the alternative explanations of consciousness from an esoteric perspective versus the scientific psychological explanation.
I think
that really created a template sort of for you to approach things in a more philosophical.
I was just going to say, especially when I came then to Gurdjieff, and Gurdjieff said consciousness is something different from the psychological function.
Yeah.
It's not thinking, it's not sensation, it's not emotions or feelings. Consciousness is something other, and sometimes Gurdjieff compares it to light, and then sometimes to space. So Sartre kind of, like, I was impressed by the reasoning of Sartre, like what Sartre says about how everything we think we are, like we are not. You know, I could say, well, I'm so many years old. Well, I'm not. You know, I've just aged, you know, and I kind of, we have all these stages and phases of life. There's nothing, seemingly, nothing impermanent except this kind of impermanency, which is permanent in a sense.
Well, that's the Buddhist nature, is that the belief in impermanence is that, you know, that there is nothing permanent and everything is in transition. And even, like, really, like, that's a very profound concept that doesn't really make its way into a lot of our psychological and scientific thinking, is that we tend to think about things and speak about things as if they're fixed in kind of mechanical ways. And to a certain extent, that's a useful way to think about things, but it really sort of denies the whole dynamic nature of everything, everything from the constituents of our physical bodies to our whole psychological existence and our consciousness. Everything is always changing. Everything is always dynamic and in movement, and there is no permanent element except this higher dimensional element, which we're not aware of. So in effect, in our normal state of consciousness and in the world as we normally perceive and understand it, there is nothing permanent, really. It's just, you know, as you say, the only permanent thing is impermanence. The only fixed thing is impermanence. Oh, by the way, too, that's that book that you were talking about, I think it's A Search in Secret India, not Egypt, by Paul Brunton, because that's where he meets...
In India. Yeah, he had another one, which was A Search in Egypt.
About Egypt, His books are very interesting. Those are kind of classic spiritual seeker books, because he was a journalist and someone who was interested in this, but kind of and a Westerner. I think one of the first people who really sort of took that task seriously.
Yeah. Well, so then this kind of brings us to the first book we were going to discuss this week, which we had begun discussing last week, but I hadn't finished it at that time, and I've gotten through it all now. And I think it's an excellent book. It's called Consciousness Beyond Life, The Science of the Near-Death Experience, by Pim van Lommel, who's a cardiologist from the Netherlands. And he's another one of these researchers, Jim, who I think began as a skeptic.
Yeah.
Like Sabon did and Atwater. There's a number of them who Raymond Moody, I think, began to try to disprove these things. And they ended up kind of being converted or having to face the facts.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very interesting, even with respect to this phenomenon of the near-death experience, I think that's a very, very telling and interesting aspect of it, is that I think all of the major researchers that I know, I don't know about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, but I know Kenneth Ring, and I think Moody, too, the people who really initiated this, they started out as skeptics and were sort of not at all believers in the reality of them. I mean, I'm sure that Ring and Saban, the cardiologist, they definitely didn't believe in it. And yet they're through extensive investigation, and I think Dr. van Lommel falls into the same camp too. And that's really I mean, I think that makes their work that much more compelling to me, because I think they really came with an open mind, because obviously they changed their mind. So they didn't just sort of set out to find some sort of pat explanation to dismiss these phenomena, the phenomenon of the near-death experience. And they realized, I think once you, anybody who studies this with any kind of an open mind and really starts to put all the pieces together, like the common elements in the experience itself, like the phenomenology of it for the individuals who report this experience, and then the more objective elements where people describe being out of their bodies and observing certain resuscitation procedures and certain aspects of things from perspectives which could only be evidence that they were somewhere physically out of their body, like the famous example of the person who saw the shoe on the window ledge, or who describe in detail procedures which they would not have any knowledge of before in terms of their resuscitation. So there's that element to it. And then there's all the attempts to, well, what physically could be going on here which might explain it? Because it's very complex as to what, you know, did. I mean, von Lommel goes through all of these things about the different chemical explanations. The most famous one is sort of that people are simply anoxic, and but that really does not hold up. That's been sort of the skeptic's dismissive sort of default position, but that doesn't hold up at all.
That's one of the valuable aspects of the book. He goes through all of these reductionistic alternate explanations and proves, like, there's no data for any of them.
Yeah, exactly.
It's those skeptics, they think, if they can come up with a possible other explanation, then that resolves the mystery, and it doesn't at all. He talks about, for instance, these people in these near-death experiences, they have lucid consciousness.
Yeah.
And this is at a time when their brain activity has almost ceased. And there's no...
Has ceased.
Yeah, in some cases entirely. And he is saying, like, the example of anoxia, which means a lack of oxygen, for people not familiar with the term. It couldn't possibly explain how you could have these vivid images, and people retain the memories of it and experience of it, and they themselves report the lucidity of their experience. And this is supposed to do to kind of anoxia in the dying brain. He goes through these different biochemical or biophysical explanations, and he kind of disproves them one after the other. And he's kind of led to this inevitable conclusion that is, well, we'll explain some of his views, but he kind of sees there as being a non-local field that underlies our familiar space-time, and that consciousness has access to, it's like a focal point out of this non-local field, which subtends things or underlies things. We'll come to some of his views.
One of the other aspects too, like as I said, there's phenomenology of this experience, and there are consistent elements. I mean, people do have very different experiences, but most people are aware of kind of the idea that many people experience traveling down this tunnel and then coming to this source of light and experiencing this radiant light, which is very beautiful and which is not at all blinding, but which is incredibly brilliant, and then often being met by deceased relatives or loved ones or having encounters with these beings of light, and having these experiences of affirmation and a profound feelings of love and the effect of this for people on often being given a choice as to whether or not they want to return to life on this plane and in their planetary body or to continue to end their existence on this plane and to pass over into this other dimension. And then having these transformative, transcendent experiences where their attitudes when they come back to life about things are very, very, very profoundly changed. And Huxley, Aldous Huxley, once spoke about the visionary experience in general. It's just saying that people have this experience of the essential all rightness of the universe, and the idea that also that they lose their fear of death. And so that these are very profound experiences for a lot of people. Not everybody has that experience, but a lot of people do. And it doesn't. It seems to be independent of. One of the skeptical explanations is that people are sort of fulfilling some sort of conditioning and expectations, but actually the evidence doesn't suggest that at all. It seems to be quite independent of whether or not, for instance, someone is religious or not religious before, whether or not somebody believes in afterlife or not, whether or not someone has any kind of, even like their feelings or like their attitudes towards other people, whether or not they're humanitarians or more kind of selfish and materialistic. And it just seems to be absolutely, it doesn't seem to be the fulfillment of any sort of conditioning. Perhaps some of the experiences people have with seeing Jesus, for instance, may be kind of explicable in terms of people's conditioning, but definitely there's elements of these experiences that seem to be universal and seem to have nothing to do with people's conditioning and expectations. In fact, quite the contrary in many cases, which makes the phenomenon itself so much more rich and complex, and I think just to say one thing is about all of this in terms of the skeptical response to it. The importance of this experience, if it's real, and I think the evidence is overwhelming, is that it is real. I think one reason why skeptics fight it so hard and why they refuse to recognize how important it is because it completely overturns the materialist explanation of life and consciousness. It's clearly untenable in light of these experiences because if you're going to make a prediction based on scientific knowledge, if you say if your heart stops and you have no brain activity, what would the nature of an individual's experience be? Well, modern science is very clear-cut on that. There would be no experience. It would be like people would be in a state of nothingness. They would be dead. But precisely the opposite occurs. And as you say, the anoxic explanation is really dopey because people have these lucid experiences of consciousness, precisely the opposite of that. They're not in a coma, that they're conscious, but they're conscious in another dimension. So that's another problem, because where is this other dimension? It's just such a profoundly anomalous, enigmatic, mysterious experience in it, but it goes beyond casting doubt on the materialist explanation. It proves that the materialist explanation is not correct as we interpret it now. Like there's no question about this. And I think that's why people either have fought it so hard in terms of skeptical explanations and tried so desperately to explain it away, or have just not recognized how important this is. This is incredibly important because in the other book that we're going to talk about, there's a quote from John Searle where he says it's a simple fact of nature that brains cause consciousness.
Yeah.
That John Searle is a philosopher who's allegedly an expert on consciousness. But if I don't know how he can say that, because here's evidence that these brains aren't causing consciousness. These brains are inactive. They're dead.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's why I just, the more I study this, the more I realize, I really firmly believe, and I think I realize how important this is, because it just throws everything over, turns everything over, and just shows that our current understanding in terms of the materialist position just does not hold water. It just can't explain this.
That's what I thought was so valuable about this book, is that it really brought it together.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, guys, we can't not face this problem.
Yeah.
You know, because he repeatedly comes back to the kind of Western belief. He shows it's really just a belief that the mind produces the brain, the brain produces the mind and consciousness, and the belief that there's a biological basis of consciousness. But he comes to the conclusion that consciousness doesn't have a biological base at all, because it can exist even completely independently of the physical body and mind. and he's brave and kind of facing that. And he doesn't know the answers. I mean, he says, like, he doesn't try to pretend that he's explaining what it is or how it works. And he offers some suggestions, which we'll be looking at, some important ideas.
Yeah.
It just opens up another mystery. Like, but in a way, it's the most profound mystery, I would say, in psychology and science.
Yeah.
Because it's a mystery. It's not a mystery just about some phenomena in the external world, but it's the mystery of our very own self-existence. So it is like this ultimate mystery that science hasn't even begun to touch.
And it's a mystery about the universe, too, because where is this that people are, I think there's a where to this, like is these extra-dimensional experiences with these planes. Like, I mean, it what it does, too, is that, you know, the other side of it is that, so interestingly, you know, the common criticism that people make about mystical and esoteric teachings from a skeptical materialist perspective is that, well, they can't predict anything that can be corroborated scientifically. Well, this is an example of something that if you follow a mystical or esoteric teaching, you would predict what happens when people die. Well, when people's physical bodies die. Well, mystics and esotericists say that, you know, you pass into these other dimensions. Well, guess what? That's exactly what people have experienced when they've had these near-death experiences, when there's a flatline EEG and EKG, like they don't have any heart or brain activity, but they don't die. And that's so telling. And also, like it's the commonality with the visionary experience that people have had under all sorts of circumstances, and both intentionally and unintentionally, where people have these transcendent experiences where they're in these higher dimensions of supernal light and they have these transformative experiences. This is exactly what so many people experience in the near-death experience. And again, you could acquire those experiences intentionally through observing disciplines and all sorts of involving all sorts of activities, from fasting to breathing to exercises to meditation to all sorts of procedures that have been used in various esoteric and mystical teachings, and you can have them spontaneously. But there's this common element that or the series of common elements that run through these experiences. It's funny because I realized, you know, in Van Lommel's book, he talks about these elements that people transcended elements of people's experiences who had these higher experiences when they were supposedly dead. And I realized that, you know, my own life, in terms of my own spiritual seeking, like, it's as if I've had a near-death experience, because all of the values that these people report, you know, acquiring through their near-death experiences, I would endorse them all, because they're basically the values that I've acquired through my own spiritual seeking.
Oh, yeah, it's very interesting. I would say the same for myself.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah. Yeah, that interesting point. I mean, that's what they say of spiritual practice. In a way, it's a way of preparation for death.
Yeah.
In a way, we're trying to develop something in ourselves that can persist beyond death, because the illusory and false aspects of our psyche have no kind of continued existence into afterlife states. Well, actually, that's not true, which we'll come to in ways that's not true. We'll come to that. Because I wanted to go through, I have a series of quotes from the book, because you're the same age, Jim, you're a marker when you read a book. I don't think I can read a book without having a pen or pencil.
Because
it's like, if I want to go back and remember what it was or construct what I just read, it's like, if I don't mark it, then, you know, I don't know where it is, like where the essential things were.
Yeah, exactly. And I have all sorts of different levels of comment, but just to make it easier for me to find the parts that I found most kind of important. And I'm a big marker of books. It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a fast way of rereading. Like, sometimes I reread books, so I just kind of go through and look for the really the parts that I seem to really have struck me, you know. So
yeah, exactly. So yeah. You can review a book in 20 minutes or something.
This is a very, very substantive book, and I you know, I think we both are of the view that anybody interested in the near-death experience really should read this. I think anybody who's interested in any kind of in consciousness or in any kind of paranormal experiences should really, I would highly recommend this book. I think it's, and there are many other good books in the field. I think that's one of the things about this area of research is that the quality of so many of the books is so good. And so David Lorimer is another writer who's written a couple of very good books I've read on the near-death experience. But
I was thinking of Dean Radin. Who's very excellent books. His area is slightly different. It's not near-death experiences so much as like paranormal and psychic phenomena.
Yeah.
But he has the same kind of academic, scholarly, scientific approach. And it's like all of these people, they seem to arrive at the point. They say, well, you know, it's inescapable. We have to, you know, it's like after a while, the evidence is just so overwhelming, we just have to face reality. It's funny how the skeptics kind of think that people who believe in life after death can't face the reality of death. But in a way, it's like the opposite. It's like the opposite, yeah.
That's what I was getting at a bit when I was talking about the skeptics, is I think they're so desperately, you know, clinging to trying to frantically come up with some sort of explanation for this experience because it's so threatening to them. Clearly, I don't know what happens, you know, when people die, but I think that I'm open-minded enough, and I think that you're open-minded enough about this that we're not afraid of the results. But I do think that people who claim that, you know, people refuse to accept that, you know, when they die that's the end of things, that there's something wrong with them. Well, you know, I'd say the opposite now in light of this evidence. I just think it's so compelling. And this is a particularly interesting bit of research because he was actually published, his long-term study was published in the Lancet, the most prestigious of the British medical journals, which is essentially the equivalent of the New England Journal of Medicine, and very mm-hmm. important journal, and you know, very difficult to get published anything in the Lancet, and this was accepted. So he's clearly approached it from a very scholarly and academic perspective, but he's also I'm impressed with the fact that he's able to refer to various other disciplines. He talks about physics and he talks about some esoteric teachings and he certainly brings other elements into it and philosophical teachings.
Yeah, he tries to begin to develop some scientific basis for kind of understanding what could be happening, like how to understand this.
Yeah.
I had another response to, I want to say, just to go back, it reminds me also, it's like when it was almost like 40 years ago, I went through a similar process of kind of arriving at a point where I decided within myself that, okay, it's no use anymore trying to just prove a phenomena exists. Instead, what we have to try to understand is how could it work? Because most of the near-death experiences are just reporting the phenomena, but they don't take that kind of further step as to, well, what does this really mean? How could it work? And that's what we need to be doing now. And he offers that in his book, because it's not just a recounting of different experiences of people. It's an attempt to formulate what could underlay this. Because if there are other dimensions of existence and so on, there has to be a physics to these things. There has to be a science to it. So we, you know, somehow reality is so amazingly different from what we ordinarily assume it to be. And I want to go through some quotes and experiences from his book and kind of highlights, like, just some of the enigmas we have to face. I have a few quotes here, Jim. I'm gonna.
Sure. Yeah.
If you have your book with you, I'll give you the page number.
Okay.
And page 19. Here he's just talking a little bit about the out-of-body experiences, but he's saying that they have retained their identity with the faculty of sight, with the emotions, and with an extremely lucid consciousness. Now, I've been making this point for many years because I remember reading Ian Curry's book, You Cannot Die, The Results of a Century of Research on Death. And Ian Curry and other researchers have reported that most people, when they're out of their bodies, they feel almost completely themselves, the same as they feel when they're in their body.
Yeah.
And see, they're not only conscious, okay, these people out of their body, they're still capable of thinking. They still have personal identity. They still have memory. They still have perception. They can visually see. Okay. So what it suggests is that if people are out of their body and yet they're still thinking, feeling with personal identity, memory, and consciousness, and they feel almost completely themselves, what it shows us is really our thoughts and feelings and sensations and so on were never simply produced by the material body. Because, see, if they were, well, then you wouldn't have all these faculties at the when you're out of your body. So it's, see, most people think that our normal self-experience when we're in the body is produced by the body. But what this is saying, no, even your normal experience, like even what you're experiencing right now, it's not being produced by your physical body. There's something that's inhabiting the body. There's something going on that's deeper than the material body. Your body never produced these phenomena. It's tied into their operation in the material body, but we have all of these faculties even apart from the body. And just down lower on that page, he says, the range of vision can extend to 360 degrees with simultaneous detailed and bird's eye views.
Yeah.
Now, this is very interesting because, see, normally when we have our vision, we see it in a limited way. We see something from one perspective. But when you're said to be in states of samadhi, you're said to experience things simultaneously, all perspective, because you're not kind of seeing something just simply from one perspective, but it's like you're pervading a volume of space. And this is what is partly involved in different states of samadhi. So the vision here, he's saying, is 360 degrees. And it reminds me of Yogananda's experience of cosmic consciousness, where he's sitting in an ashram, and his master initiates his experience of cosmic consciousness by striking him over the heart and saying, nothing can fulfill your heart's desire. Poor Yogananda. So he taps him on the heart, which awakens Yogananda's heart. And one of the first thing he experiences, he's kind of seeing things simultaneously, all perspective. And he's aware of everything around him in the ashram. And he's aware of, like, the trees, the roots of the trees under the ground. Like, he's experiencing, his consciousness is in the whole volume of space. And it's because he's closer to this realm of nothingness that he can kind of interpenetrate the volume of space and be aware of it all simultaneously. It makes sense.
It, like when he talks about as he starts to, his consciousness starts to expand, he says it's like he could see out of the back of his head because he sees this cow walking down the road, which is behind him. He's nowhere and he's everywhere at the same time, and it just keeps. Yeah, I was very struck by that too, is that people have this experience, and it's exactly what Yogananda describes in his experience of cosmic consciousness, and also that Kenneth Ring has done it, and Von Lommel mentions on the same page that about blind people being able to see and deaf people being able to hear. Ring has done work on the blind people being able to see in the
yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, it's fascinating how these people were able to see, because sometimes they say that if you're able to restore sight to a blind person, it can be so disconcerting and difficult for them that it's hardly worth it.
Yeah. That's what really struck me. Oliver Sacks has a famous paper about that, about a man who had his sight restored, and he actually, it was so difficult for him that he preferred the state of being blind. So it's quite amazing, because it just, it refers to the, how the sight, seeing isn't simply a physical process, it's a complex interaction of your mind and your, and the physical capacity to have light enter your optic nerves and be transmitted to your brain. And it's very complex, and it's partly socially conditioned. And these people had no problem with it at all, which really struck me as being, wow, that's, not only is it odd that people can see who are blind, but that it was sensible to them. Now, that in and of itself is so interesting. Right? Like, it's, because it's not what you, again, it's not what you would expect, and it's not what people who have, as you say, who have restored sight, it's not at all what they experience, who have been blind most of their lives.
So what's up with that? It's all very interesting, because it gives us, like, when we know these different features, it gives us insight into trying to understand what we're trying to understand. Okay, I move along here. I've got page 31. Okay. And this is, he quotes this long near-death experience of George Ritchie, who was an American doctor, one of the first to investigate near-death experiences. And it's Ritchie's account that originally affected Raymond Moody that set him on his task to try to disprove Ritchie, and then he started finding all these cases. But anyway, I thought this is... Here he's describing what he calls the hell worlds, or what he refers to as the society of the damned. And I think this is a really interesting... description of some of the spaces that some people enter upon death. And here's a little bit of what he says. If I suspected before that I was seeing hell, now I was sure of it. Up to this moment, the misery I had been watching consisted in being chained to a physical world of which we were no longer part. Now I saw that there were other kinds of chains. These creatures seem to be locked into habits of mind and emotion, into hatred, lust, destructive thought patterns. Now here, what he's describing is very interesting. It's like these people are locked into their habits of mind and emotions. And this, I think, is what I've found throughout the mystical literature, is that they say, your psychological state before you die, it is responsible for what you would experience on the other side. Like, for instance, Blavatsky explains it. She says, you know, there's seven overall planes to existence. Each of these planes is said to have seven subplanes. So you say you pass over into the astral world. Well, there are said to be seven levels to the astral world, and the higher levels are depicted as up into the atmospheres, and these are said to be the paradise worlds, up in the atmospheres, whereas the lower astral worlds are where entities that haunt the earth or are drawn into underworld conditions. So you might imagine you have seven levels of the astral plane. So what level of the astral plane will a person gravitate to? And the way it's explained is that you'll be drawn into those levels corresponding to your own makeup, which makes total sense, eh, Jim?
Yeah.
Because you're just drawn into those realms established by your own patterns of thinking and feeling. Yeah. So you kind of live in these hallucinogenic worlds, almost, created by your own habits of thinking and feeling. It's kind of a nightmare. Wouldn't that be awful?
I was kind of thinking about that for myself. Like, oh my God, a baseball park where the game never stops. There's a lot of drinking and cats. And books. Yeah, no.
Okay,
that's a very interesting comment, though. I have that same thing marked. It's very interesting what he's saying about that. These creatures seem to be locked into habits of mind and emotion, hatred, lust, destructive thought patterns. And again, it's kind of people who are dominated by negative emotions go to a sphere in which people are dominated by negative emotions. You know,
it makes total sense.
You know, like karmically, it fits.
Yeah, like Gurdjieff explains how you're drawn to the level like of your specific gravity. So if you've accumulated a lot of these dense astral energies, then it's you'll be drawn into those realms.
Yeah,
that's why Gurdjieff emphasizes so much like struggling with negative emotions, learning to be free of them. So that when we pass over, we're not drawn into these lower worlds of this kind of hell worlds where people are quite lost in these realms. I'll read a little bit more.
Okay.
Even more hideous than the bites and kicks they exchanged with the sexual abuses many were performing in fervish pantomime. Whenever anyone thought, however fleetingly or unwillingly, was instantly apparent to all around him, more completely than the words could have expressed.
Wow.
And the thoughts most frequently communicated had to do with the superior knowledge or abilities or background of the thinker. It's like they're all competing with themselves, eh? Like all egomaniacs together. But all the elites will have fun in the afterlife world.
I was going to say.
That's so funny in Beelzebub's tales. Jeff describes all the kind of hell worlds that the Husnamuses go to. Where they have to be kind of broken down and the thought, I'm picking up on the quote, and the thoughts most frequently communicated had to do with, the superior knowledge or abilities, okay, or background of the thinker. So the competitiveness. What was it going to be like, I thought with sudden panic, to live forever where my most private thoughts were not private at all? No disguising them, no covering them up, no way to pretend I was anything but what I actually was. How unbearable. Perhaps in the course of eons or of seconds, each creature here had sought out the company of others as pride and hate-filled as himself, until together they formed this society of the damned. So,
wow.
I think that's really interesting. You know, he talks throughout the book a little bit about people who go into these hell worlds or lower worlds, and I believe these exist. And I remember hearing the inventor of macrobiotics, I forget, he's a Japanese fellow, spoke in Paris, and I heard a lecture by him, and he was very psychically sensitive, and he just described going around Paris and how he just saw all these ghosts and entities haunting everywhere, eh, for people who are perceptive. And he could just see all these entities, like there'd be this whole kind of lower life of people who hang on and haunt the familiar places. So the society of the damned. Yeah, it's nice to think that these elites will get their due after death, eh?
Yeah.
I mean, I just... You know, it just makes so much sense, eh? Like, what did they say in the Bible? The vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Is that the line?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can just see it's true, eh? Because all these kind of tyrants through history, and none of them, or very infrequently, do they ever face justice in this life. They all have this impunity that they can get away with anything. And it's like, oh, yeah, the last laugh. All these guys will be all in their little hell worlds together, you know. It's a nice thought.
There's a thing, is it George Osawa?
That's the inventor of macrobiotics.
Yukikazu Sakuzawa. Is the name that I see on the
gave a fascinating lecture talking about seeing all the ghosts and entities all over Paris.
That's so interesting that you know, because I really do believe, again, I'm absolutely convinced that there are people who do see these entities and who are sensitive to them, you know. I mean, it seems like very interesting in the other book, the 2012 book, when he's talking about Steiner, Rudolf Steiner, and how as a young person he was so sensitive and could perceive all these things that nobody else could perceive. I really do believe that there are people who have that gift, you know. And like that's the idea of like space being interpenetrated by all these different planes. Like you don't have to go anywhere. That's all sort of there. Like they're all interpenetrating. We just aren't aware of them.
There's a quote in my book on God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, which is a quote I refer to as Blavatsky's description of holographic space.
Yeah.
And what she describes is exactly like what you just depicted. Like she said, there could be countless beings and worlds, all within our own space, but you just can't. You don't have the facilities to perceive them.
Perceive them, yeah.
Yeah, and it reminds me of like if you have a holographic plate. And you have a laser light, and you can shine the light through the plate, and it'll project an image out into space. But you can kind of move that laser around, and you can project all these different images. And I think it's very analogous.
Yes.
Okay, and another thing. Yeah, I thought, okay, this one, this quote is about the life review, and I think it's interesting. It's page 36. My whole life so far appeared to be placed before me in a kind of panoramic, three-dimensional review, and each event seemed to be accompanied by an awareness of good and evil, or by an insight into its causes and effect. Throughout, I not only saw everything from my point of view, but I also knew the thoughts of everybody who had been involved in these events, as if their thoughts were lodged inside me. It meant that I saw not only what I had done or thought, but even how this had affected others, as if I was seeing with all-knowing eyes. So even our thoughts are apparently not wiped out. Now, I think this is very interesting, and these panoramic life reviews, and not always panoramic, because sometimes people just have flashes. They don't have a panoramic view necessarily, even though sometimes it's a fuller panoramic view. But it's like these people, one, they seem often to have a presence there with them that helps them kind of see and judge things. Hey, Jim, have you noticed that? There's often like a presence there.
It's the beings of light or a being of light that is accompanying them. And as you say, the passage you just read, I have to say that it wasn't until a few years ago when I read David Lorimer's books on the near-death experience, I didn't realize how frequently people have. I knew, about people having this, the classic experience of their life flashing before them, but it's very detailed, and they everything they've ever experienced, which in and of itself is very interesting because it's happening in a relatively short time, it seems so. But I wasn't aware that how many people had this experience that this person is describing, where they're not only aware of themselves, but the effect of everything that they were thinking and feeling had on everybody else. So I think this is so fascinating. I think this is, again, this like it goes to the very complex holographic nature of reality, where everything is enfolded into everything else. And like when people say that they are one with the universe, I mean, we really are all one in a sense. That's what I take from this, that somehow all of these experiences that we have as ourselves as discrete beings are somehow fundamentally they're secondary or tertiary or whatever. They're a distant level of existence from what is actually at the heart of being. Like there's something much more, but there's a unity at the heart of being that I think that this signifies this experience. It's interesting that the next sentence too in this account is just
Go ahead.
Were you going to say, and throughout the review, stress the importance of love. Like, that's another element that comes up over and over again about how important love is. And not egoistic, self-centered love, but just love.
Yeah.
Like, as this, and this it, higher order energy and intelligence of love.
Yeah. Yeah.
It may be the deal for, right?
He says the review stressed the importance of love. Again, it's like there's that presence there that's stressing the importance of love while the person views their own life.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like it comes from them so much, even though it's in them. But, I think there's this kind of presence that helps people understand as they go through the past life review. I think that element is often there.
Yeah.
But it also, what's so fascinating about it, like, this brings up what people sometimes call the Akashic field. And that's a belief or a teaching in the occultism that at some level there is persistent memory of everything that ever happened since the beginning of creation. That at some level everything is interrelated and everything is a part of the whole, so everything is kind of enfolded into everything else. I'm not sure exactly what that's got to, but what it shows is there has to be some kind of level, like there has to be something like an Akashic field that, like, this is what the Dalai Lama talks about too, when he says. The Dalai Lama explains, when life comes into a human being, the impermanent drop, he says, is within the heart chakra. And that's, the permanent drop. So as long as the body alive, that element is in the heart. And he says the energy is spread out from there through the three channels, through the seven chakras, and then through all the winds of the bodies and through the different channels. But then as a person approaches death, all these energies ingather again. So the person's hands and feet start getting cold and clammy, and all the energy gathers into the side channels, and then all the energies withdraw into the heart. And then the Dalai Lama says as the energies draw into the heart, then the soul leaves the body. But as the energies withdraw into the heart, that's when the Dalai Lama stresses, that's when you have this life review occur.
Right.
That's why in my book I'm trying to explain how there's this, sevenfold monadic essence with seven mini black holes, which is an information processor, and that's kind of existing within the Akashic field. But that's partly the concept. That in a way, it's like something withdrawing into a black hole, because the heart's like a black hole. And when
you have all this information collapsing kind of into this concentrated...
Yeah, exactly, as you do with the black hole, which you do, because the physicists now think that when matter and energy collapse into a black hole, what spews out is information. Which is related to what draws into the heart. So it really makes quite sense that in some way the heart is like a mini black hole. I actually say in Blavatsky it's seven mini black holes, but it's like there's one black hole and then it differentiates into seven.
Yeah, and
so
and
there's
and
this interior structure. Sorry, Jim.
I was just going to say it's not just the physical heart. It's like not the physical heart. It's because the physical heart's activity is stopping, but it's withdrawing into the higher dimensional heart spaces and dimensions of the heart. And I think this is entirely consistent with what you're describing in your model. I think it makes perfect sense. It's like as with what the Dalai Lama is saying, is that everything in gathers, and so just as we emerge out of this, like life and consciousness emerge out of these higher dimensions, then they withdraw back into these higher dimensions. That's exactly what mystics and esotericists say. And then this guy or this person, I don't even know if this is a man or woman that we're talking about, but it says, I can't say how long this life review and insight into life lasted. It may have been quite long because it covered every single subject, but at the same time, it felt like a split second because I saw everything at once. It seemed as if time and distance didn't exist. I was everywhere at once, and sometimes my attention was focused on something, and then I was there too, which is such, you know, again, we're talking about dimensionality in which all of our usual notions about time and space don't hold.
Yeah.
And that again kind of is perfectly consistent with this idea of like of this collapsing of everything and then this information.
Yeah.
Coming out. You know, it's like it's perfect. It's like it's, you know, it I don't know how it works.
Yeah, it also ties in it reminds me also of you in yoga psychology. In the book of The Science of the Heart, they say, like, all your past life memories are all associated with the heart. And it's like you might imagine all these different layers to the heart. And as you kind of withdraw into the heart, it could, it's like it's due to the kind of metaphysics of the human heart that we could have memories of different lives. I'm not sure what I'm trying to say, but I mean, it all ties into the access of our access to the Akashic record is really, I would say, through the heart and our memory of past lives and the life review, I think, all have to do with these physics of the heart. Okay, so I'm going to move along a little bit and pick up after. Okay, and I just want, I thought this is a nice, this is page 82, and he quotes from the Egyptian Book of the Dead, from Papyrus of Ani, around 1250 BC. People believe that after death, the soul leaves the earth and sets off on a journey through the underworld, where a final challenge awaits the deceased before he can enter the hereafter, the judgment of Osiris. This involved the enumeration of a long list of sins which the deceased denied committing. The truth of this denial was then established by weighing the heart against a feather. If the deceased spoke the truth and the heart was not weighed down by sin, he or she would be ensured of blissful immortality within sight of the sun god. But a dreadful fate awaited those who failed the test of truth, as these sinners were condemned into eternal oblivion. Again, I guess the main point of this is that it really stresses that it's the condition of the heart that determines your afterlife fate. And I think this kind of shows it. It's like the weighing of the heart. And that kind of determines whether Gurdjieff in Beelzebub's Tales has a similar story. He talks about how people in the afterlife, they have an angel on one side and the devil on the other side, and they're kind of weighing, you know, who gets the soul, and the soul is kind of weighed between these two forces and either gets to escape into heaven and the sun world of the sun god or is taken off into the lower realms. And it all has to do in different traditions with the weighing of the heart. And again, I just think that all, you know, it goes along with what I say in the heart doctrine. And so I think that's the weighing of the heart. I think that's a great image. Okay, and then he quotes in the same page, he quotes from ancient India, must be the Upanishads, and he quotes, "Coming and going is all pure delusion. The soul never comes nor goes. Where is the place to which it shall go when all space is in the soul? When shall be the time for the entering and departing when all time is in the soul?" And this is very interesting because it's like, to understand mystical concepts, it involves a very alternate model of understanding the nature of space. Like Blavatsky says, four-dimensional space-time is really simply illusion. And she says it doesn't really exist. And her space is like holographic space, where everything is happening simultaneously. And in a way, it's like the soul doesn't come or go anywhere. In a way, what this Upanishad is saying, it's like the soul is established in itself. And all the coming and goings, these are just illusory, that's the illusion. But really, the soul never goes anywhere. It's the same place the whole time. I'm not sure what I'm trying to say about this, but it's like the soul is this, the way I would explain it, I'd say the like monad is established in higher dimensional space. And so it doesn't move about, like it's not moving about in four-dimensional space-time. No, it's established in higher dimensional space. And all the movement in four-dimensional space-time is all something created as levels of illusion surrounding the soul established in higher dimensional space. Does that, when I come across what I'm trying to get at, Jim?
Yeah, I think I know what you're saying. I'm not sure.
Well, it's amazing because, you know, you have these people, they, in their near-death experiences, it's like if you will to go somewhere or to see someone, it happens instantaneously. And what he tries to, he calls this non-local space, which is what I would call hyperspace, would be another term. Blavatsky would call it the eternal parent space, that there's a higher dimensional space that underlies familiar space-time. And I'm not sure what I was going to say about that, but that's the concept, that the self is established in this higher dimensional space, so it kind of doesn't move anywhere. Yeah. It always reminds me also, it's like the paradox of how, like, no matter where I might go in the world, no matter where I travel, the end of the world, anywhere in the world I might want to go, and I'm still there. It's like myself is still under my nose, and it makes no difference wherever I go, it's still in the same place with respect to me in some way. I'm not sure what I'm trying to get at.
Well,
All the movement is illusory
in a way. It's like you're still always rooted into yourself, so it's like,
Anyway, I was going to read a little bit of Dante's description of hell, a summary of it, in page 83. In hell, Dante's figure from the Divine Comedy meets people enduring eternal punishment for their intemperaments, lust, gluttony, avarice, prodigality, I'm not even sure, and wrath. For their violence against others, oneself, God, and nature, and for their deceit, usury, fortune-telling, bribery, theft, false counsel, forgery, and betrayal of family, homeland, and God. So, in purgatory, so he meets all these people confined there for these, some of the seven deadly sins. Then in purgatory, he meets dead people who are there on account of pride, envy, wrath, lovelessness, avarice, gluttony, and lust. And then he talks about in paradise, where he encounters saints and God's eternal light. Anyway, I guess the main point of it all is that as we live our life, that in a way that determines our afterlife fate. And I mean, it's a comforting idea for me because I you know, sometimes I just, these scoundrels who wreck such havoc and suffering upon humankind, and it's just sometimes the injustice and outrage of it all is just, you know, it's just so overwhelming. I have such a sense of justice. It's so outrageous. It's been what's been done. Eh? Like the wars, all based on lies and the deception of the public by our governments and everything. It's just so. It's beyond what most people could imagine. You know, all the depravity of it all. You know, and the suffering of it all. So I must say, I do like the idea of an afterlife, and that these people will, you know, the revenge is mine, saith the Lord, you know, and I'm glad someone is going to, you know, that these people will pay for what they've done in their afterlife states and conditions. And I think these people don't imagine that. They can't live like that. I think these people must be very afraid of death, because they will then have to face the consequences of what they've done and be in realms with everybody else just like them. I think that would be it's like the hell of their own design, eh? It's like everybody designs your own hell, because you kind of create it, you're drawn into it with similar souls.
Well, you reap what you sow.
Yeah, you reap what you sow. Yeah.
But I mean that extends to everything. I mean, what it says, if this is true, is that not only is your life meaningful in terms of this plane and this existence, but it's meaningful beyond, and it's on another plane. Like, you know, so if you're a good person, or if you're virtuous, and if you strive to serve others and to, you know, to love, then you're going to there is a reward for it, you know, like you're doing. I would say it's like you're doing the work of the higher forces and intelligence. So you can call that God, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, like some sort of supreme being. But I think that's the whole. That's where I say I would think that there's, to a certain extent, all of this corroborates the idea that in various mystical and esoteric teachings and religious teachings that. That something like that, as simple as you reap what you sow. That's not just it's not just to describe what happens on this plane or in this life, but for our lives beyond this life, you know.
And that's very important. I would say it's like a law of physics.
Yeah, well, it's karma.
It's karma. But karma is actually a law of physics. It's like sometimes it's compared. You take a young sapling tree, and you bend it over and over and over and over more and more, and then at some point when you let go, it snaps back ever so harder.
Yeah.
And it's like these people, they get away with more and more and more and more and more, and they think they get away with it all, and then it all, as John Lennon says, instant karma. Instant karma is going to catch you. I love that song.
That's why it makes sense when people have these experiences where these transcendent experiences and these near-death experiences where they say they understand the essential all-rightness of the universe. That it's like not just sort of pie-in-the-sky feelings, but rather that there's a lawfulness to all of this, and that you know, nobody escapes the consequences of their actions, you know,
that
you know, things do work out on a different plane, you know. And I mean, it's comforting. I hope that's true, you know. Like, I mean, I hope that's true for the good people, and I hope that's true for all the people who suffer terrible misfortune, you know, and have terrible things done to them, and you know, that somehow this, I like the idea that karmically people are working things out, and maybe they come back and they're, you know, like they go through better experiences. Like there's got to be some sort of justice to this all, and this tends to indicate that there is, you know, like,
yeah. And yeah, it's kind of built into the,
certainly doesn't exist on this plane.
No, you sure don't see it on this plane. It's just unbelievable. You see the suffering of so many people in third world countries, and who are just the victims of all these machinations of the elites. You know, it's terrible.
Yeah,
you know,
it exists everywhere. I mean, people do awful things to people everywhere. It's just like, you know, and people do wonderful things for people too. Like, you know, you have to remember that there's always these good forces too, trying to do good things, you know, and trying to be unselfish and you know, positive emotions, and so, you know,
Yeah, it's funny because I don't think in my life I don't think I've met many people of the types of these elites.
Yeah.
With that kind of arrogance and greed and
I don't know that many psychopaths.
Psychopathy, yeah. Well, I mean, I even worked in prisons for 12 years.
But most
of the guys in there, they weren't psychopaths. They were just guys. They grew up in alcohol addictions and drugs and parent abuse and that. You know, they were understandable. They still had heart.
Yeah.
These people are in the... I mean, not all of them. Some were clearly psychopaths. I remember a couple particularly.
Yeah.
But not like these elites. They show psychopathy on a whole different level. I guess that's what, like, Robert Hare was getting at, the famous Canadian psychologist, is saying most of the psychopaths are not in the jails. They're in the government and the corporate structures, and these people, it's very adaptive in ways.
They own or run jails.
Yeah, they own the jails, yeah.
Or they build more of them, you know? They pass laws to put more people in jail,
That's what they're trying to do in Canada now. They're building all these jails. All the crime rates are going down. But, I mean, they want people in jails because then they can bring companies into jails and they got slave labor that people in jails will work for 50 cents an hour to make canteen money.
There's just a lot of money in running prisons, and they'll privatize it.
There is.
You know? I mean, it's a huge industry in the United States, and that's the way we're going, you know. It's like, terrible.
Yeah, it is.
Anyway,
it really is.
Is there more?
Okay, so I'm going to continue on. I quote page 87. He's quoting from Hinduism, and he quotes again from the Upanishads. And I marked this, one of the lines, it's talking about the self. The all-knowing self was never born, nor will it die, beyond cause and effect. The self is eternal and immutable. When the body dies, the self does not die. If the slayer believes that he can kill or the slain believes that he can be killed, neither knows the truth. The eternal self slays not, nor is ever slain. And then it says, hidden in the heart of every creature exists the self, subtler than the subtlest, greater than the greatest. So what struck me a little bit in reading this is, I'm surprised a little bit that Van Lommel didn't ever come to the point of, like, considering seriously. Well, like, he's quoting this Upanishad, and yet he says, even in the Upanishad, it's saying, this subtle self is hidden in the heart of every creature.
But
Van Lommel never really considers that.
He's a cardiologist, too, yeah, I know.
Yeah, and it totally makes sense that you have all these near-death experiences associated mainly with heart attacks. I mean, there are other... Right. It's primarily with heart attacks.
Yeah.
And it makes total sense in terms of what I argue is that we are ensouled through the heart, and the self is connected to the heart. So it makes most sense, then, that when the heart stops, that's when the self separates from the body and would have these experiences. But anyway, it surprised me that at Van Lommel never quite considered this concept that the self is connected to the heart, even though he's also showing in his book that the self, I mean consciousness, is not dependent on the mind or the body at all. So when I say it's connected to the heart, and I'm saying really the heart is a multidimensional thing, it's not simply the physical heart, that the physical heart is only the lowest level of manifestation of the psychical, the spiritual, and the divine heart, like of these levels to the heart. But I was surprised. I would love to send this guy, Van Lommel, a copy of my Heart Doctrine book.
I thought the same thing when I was reading the book. I thought, you should really send him your book. I think he'd be very interested in it.
Yeah, he would be open to it. And,
yeah.
I mean, you can see from this book he is.
I think what you were talking about earlier when you were talking about going anywhere, you know, and you're still there, I think that right on that page, he quotes the Isha Upanishad. The Upanishad features an almost literal description of endless consciousness. The self seems to move, but is ever still. He seems far away, but is ever near. He is within all, and he transcends all. Those who see all creatures in themselves, and themselves in all creatures, know no fear. Those who see all creatures in themselves, and themselves in all creatures, know no grief. How can the multiplicity of life delude the one who sees its unity? The self is everywhere. Bright is the self, indivisible, untouched by sin, wise, immanent, and transcendent. He it is who holds the cosmos together.
Wow, a beautiful
that's
quote.
That's incredible. Yeah,
yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's so amazing. Like now, like we can both understand these, eh? Like
that's exactly what I was thinking. I was like, you know, I could have read that when I was in high school or university, and you know, that's nice, you know. But now it means so much more to me, you know.
Yeah, and it's so funny that Van Lommel quotes it. Like it,
but he
it
doesn't get it.
He even quotes "hidden in the heart of every creature." But he never, maybe that's got
that
something to do with it.
Yeah.
Okay, then I'm moving along a little bit. We just got 5-6 minutes left. Yeah. Beautiful quotes. Oh, he's talking after death. And, this is from the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And they're describing when a person dies that the knower will be experiencing the clear light of the natural condition.
Yeah.
And this is a neat term, this clear light of the natural condition. Because, see, it's like what I would say before, I was saying that the self is said to have its abode in the heart, in the bliss sheath, which is described as a mass of unemergent light. And I think that this is the clear light of the natural condition. Anyway, okay, skipping along here. 173. This is a beautiful quote here from a near-death experiencer. I asked if God was the light. Some guy's that experience in the higher realm. And the answer was, no, God is not the light. The light is what happens when God breathes. And this is very interesting because I'm understanding over time more and more what Blavatsky says when she's describing the eternal principles of creation. And the mother, the eternal mother, is what she calls the eternal parent space. But the eternal father is what she calls the ceaseless breath.
Yeah.
And for Blavatsky, the divine mother represents space, the divine father represents the breath and spirit. So in spiritual teachings, spirit and breath are intimately connected. And here it's saying light is what happens when God breathes. And that is actually exactly kind of what Blavatsky depicts in the stanzas of Zen, how creation occurs, is that the light is generated from the ceaseless breath and its modifications, which generates light. So I thought that's a kind of a cryptic remark. He says, God is not the light. The light is what happens when God breathes.
Yeah,
sometimes you find these ideas in these where people are just reporting their, like this person isn't studied in occultism who is describing this, but they describe things which are perfectly in alliance with esoteric teachings. That's why often it's like, why don't these people ever make mistakes? You kind of don't hear accounts where they describe something where you kind of know is like, well, no, that's not right. You don't get that. I don't see that. Instead, people have profound insights just out of their own intuitive knowledge. Okay, Jim, well, we didn't get through this book. I got as far as page 173, which is a good place to stop because that's my magical number. 137 is the number that I comes up a lot in my life. We'll be back in 2 weeks. We've got a couple minutes left. I would encourage listeners to visit www.zeropoint.ca, and I have a special on my books at the moment, and or my books are available through Amazon. Thanks, Jim. I think it was an interesting show today.
Yeah,
I think we're giving a good insight on this book, and I'd like to follow this, and then we're going to move on and discuss this other book. I think it's very useful for us to draw from other people, because then we can really highlight what we're saying and provide comparative discussion. I think it's very valuable. The other book is 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl.
Quetzalcoatl.
Yeah, which is a very interesting book.
Daniel Pinchback is the
guy. So I will finish up this book, and we'll move on to that next week, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. Any final comments, Jim?
No, when we start talking about this, it's just that there's so much to it. And as you say, I think it's interesting to talk about other people's work. Pinchback's book is very, very interesting. I've learned a ton from it, and it's just like I think he just explores a lot of things from very different perspectives that are quite consistent with what we're trying to say here, but a very different perspective. I really quite enjoyed it. I haven't quite finished it, but it's very interesting.
Yeah, it's funny because his writing style so reminded me of your writing.
Yeah,
more than anyone else, the way he kind of blends, like he was obviously really hip, like very knowledgeable, the arts and cultures and stuff like this, and just the way he kind of, like, he's kind of breezing along through life. And well, we'll come to it. It's a fascinating book, and so we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Thanks, PBS Radio. Keep hope. May the elites have a change of heart, or else you guys, you got a lot in store for you. You're going to have hell to pay, hell of your own design to pay. And I'd rather go see the sun god. That appeals to me more, rather than be a lunatic.
Yeah.
Okay, back in 2 weeks.
The dam doesn't really make it for me.
Yeah, really. They'll all be there together. Oh, God.
Okay, thanks.
Okay,
thanks,
take care.
See ya.
Thanks, PBS. Thanks, Don, Doug, Seth. Goodbye.